You build the world. The roads, schools and hospitals. That's your work. And we're with you on this journey. Procore, your trusted construction partner. Discover our construction management platform at procore.com.
Welcome to another episode of Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index. It's Wednesday, the 1st of May, 2024. Although it feels more like the 1st of March where I am. So cold I've even had to turn the heating on, which is bad for my utility bills and for the planet. But more of that later, I think. Actually, Phil, how are you doing over there in Kent? Are you any warmer than I am in Devon?
Bit chilly. Haven't got the heating on, though.
Oh, well. Well, let's warm up the conversation with talking about some of the latest news that's happened. What's the big story this week?
Well, the big story this week, I'm afraid, is doom and gloom. We saw it coming. Jeffrey Osborne has gone into administration. They announced that, put out a statement a couple of weeks ago saying that they'd filed a notice of intent to appoint an administrator. And now it's actually happened. Now, it's a sad one. Osborne is one of privately owned. I was thinking of the civil engineering contractor, but they sold their sold their civil engineering arm a couple of years ago as part of September 2021 to focus on building and family owned business. The current chairman, Andrew Osborne, was the son of Jeffrey Osborne, started in 1966 in Chichester. And they just seem to be one of those traditional, to my mind, you know, well-run, decent, successful family-owned building companies and civil engineering companies. And they're saying it's the twin impacts of COVID and Brexit have clobbered them. I think the Brexit thing is a bit, I would say, tangential. It's not, but the fact that it's a wider economic impact of Brexit.
Yes.
But you can't unpick that. I mean, they didn't mention the Russian invasion of Ukraine is an issue, but it's all the economic scenario which all of these things have put them through. But they started trying to do a bit of a restructure. They saw problems coming. As I say, back in September 2021, they sold their infrastructure arm to a private equity outfit. And then they sold off their off-site manufacturing business, Innovari Systems, in March last year. And in September last year, they sold their property maintenance business. So they've been trying to sort of rationalize, get back to basics and shore up the balance sheet. But we hadn't, because we hadn't seen any accounts for them since, what was their last filed accounts were the year to September 2021, which was when they still had the infrastructure business. I mean, that showed turnover 326 million, down from 551 million. That's a big drop, and £44 million pre-tax loss on continuing operations. But we don't really know what's been happening there since, because we haven't seen the accounts. They changed their year end. They announced they're changing their year end, so it's going to be 18 months accounts would be the next ones to come out, and we haven't had them out yet.
Well, they're overdue, aren't they?
It's irrelevant now. But I did look at the Company Watch financial analytics dashboard of Osborne. And while Company Watch's sort of credit ratings business had them in the danger zone briefly in September 2020, 4 years ago, they were back out in fairly clearly in the middle ground of safety at no particular risk. So there weren't red lights being flashed by that particular credit rating agency. So it's all sad. 100 people have lost their jobs. A few people have been retained to help with the sale. They've spent the past 2 weeks trying to find saviours, but it's all gone. Quote from Andrew Osborne: appointing administrators as a last resort after a determined effort to trade through the economic headwinds and deliver for customers. The management team will now work with the administrators on the next step for the business, which is trying to, I guess, sell contracts or get what they can.
That's a shame, isn't it? Yes, it is. They've been going since, I think, 1960s?
66.
So, quite a well-known family firm. It's a shame. Never good to see something like this happen. But so do you think they'll just disappear without trace? Or do you think that just bits and bobs will be snapped up by other contractors? And
I think they've already sold what they can sell. As I said, they've, you know, the structural arm's gone, the off-site bit's gone, and the maintenance bit's gone. I don't think if it was going
there's to nothing left to sell, really.
If it was going to be bought, I think it would have been bought in the past fortnight.
Yeah, I imagine. Yeah.
If there's any good news, is that the good people let go should not have too much trouble finding new employment, because as we know, there's massive skill shortage.
Yeah, that's true.
But that's a conversation for another day, which perhaps we ought to look at sometime.
Yeah.
Sort of bank that one as an idea for a idea for topic.
So that's Geoffrey Osborne. I don't think anybody else has gone under in the past fortnight. So maybe we can move on to another topic.
Well, according to Begbie's trainer, the insolvency practitioners, they unlikely to be the last. I mean, they're not the first. We've had other insolvencies already this year, as we've talked about in the past. And Begbie's trainer put out their latest quarterly red flag alert, saying there are 83,500 construction companies in significant financial distress at the moment, and more than 6,000 are in critical financial distress, which is a more severe stage. So it's the significant financial distress, which is less bad than critical. Not much change in the past 3 months, but it's still nearly 40% more than it was this time last year. And so it's tough out there.
It is. I mean, we've got, we'll be talking about this a little bit later in the conversation, because the magazine has just gone to press, and we've got a feature in there looking at the demolition sector. In fact, a very demolition orientated issue, actually. We've got a feature looking at why so many demolition companies seem to have been going under in the last year or so. I think five in the last 6 months. Demolition contractors, quite big ones, some of them. And, you know, it's not just demolition contractors, but specialists, actually. Specialists seem to be at risk at the moment.
We've talked before about how a lot of companies have been propped up by the, you know, during COVID, by the loans and business support that was available then, which I think kept some people going longer than they otherwise would have done.
Yes.
You know, bizarrely, they were saved by the pandemic.
Yeah, or rather, yeah, it just sort of delayed the inevitable, didn't it? That's really what happened. But yeah, and I think that a combination of things, as you say, Osborne mentioned particularly COVID and Brexit, but those are, if you like, they're sort of symbolic of a wider malaise, aren't they? Is, you know, the geopolitical factors which affect everybody, and increasing costs, labour and materials, that kind of thing. It all sort of adds together and makes life difficult, especially for smaller businesses.
Adding to the gloom, I'm afraid, new forecasts out from the Construction Products Association. They do their quarterly forecasts, and they're among the most highly regarded and respected forward-looking forecasts of for the construction industry. And they 3 months ago, they reckoned output was going to fall by 2.1% this year. Now they're saying 2.2% is going to fall by, which is not a huge change, but it's a change in the wrong direction. They are more pessimistic than they were 3 months ago. Flip side of that is that their forecast for next year has been improved from a 2% increase to a 2.1% increase next year. But that's not great.
No. I mean, it's interesting when you see figures like these forecasts and stuff like that, you get a headline that somebody like the CPA has downgraded their predictions, and it might only be a fraction of a percent, but, you know, in real terms, it might not seem like much. But as you say, it does indicate that there's something afoot. And whenever the trend goes into reverse or heads in the wrong direction, that's always a warning sign.
There's also a bit of self-fulfilling prophecy about this. Whenever forecasts come out and say, oh, it's all doom and gloom and everything's bad, people tend to respond accordingly, rein in their horns, postpone projects and investments, And that makes things worse. So it's the old thing of talking the economy down, which we're doing right now. Let's stop it. Let's say things are great. We don't believe these forecasts. Economists, what do they know? Everything's great.
Exactly.
Go out and spend, spend, spend. Like, who is it? Viv Nicholson.
Okay.
Do you know who Viv Nicholson was?
Viv Nicholson. Oh, that's right. Yeah, she won the...
The pools.
Premium bonds or pools. That's right, yes. Yeah. That's right. And she did spend it. She won what? It wasn't that much, actually, was it?
Do you know
I
what?
I don't know how much it
I've
was.
I've got no idea. Let's Google her.
Apropos, but it was back nothing in the 1960s.
She won £152,000, equivalent today to £3.6 million. She, 1961, that's before I was born.
That's right.
£152,000 she won the pools. And she said she was going to spend, spend, spend.
And she did.
Apparently, it's her husband who won it, and she said she was going to spend it. I'm just looking at it. Yes. She bought sports cars, fur coats, home appliances, jewellery, and holidays, and very quickly spent it all. But good on her. That's how to do it. Have fun.
Right. So have we got a more cheerful topic? Well, actually, no. I think the next topic on the list is something which is also rather depressing. I mean, I suppose we're talking about Scottish politics here, because as anybody who's switched on the radio or television, well, that's true. Yeah, if you're a Scottish nationalist, it hasn't been a particularly good week. Yeah, I mean, it might seem like a sort of a distant connection to the construction industry, but actually, it does have an impact. As everybody will know, the Scottish government has got its knickers in a twist at the moment, and the leader of the Scottish government, Hamza Youssef, rather put his foot in it when he kicked out the partner party, which was keeping him in office, basically.
No, they walked.
The Scottish Greens.
Didn't they walk? I thought they walked.
No, I think he said he was going to.
No,
kick him
what
out.
Happened?
All right, okay.
He can't kick him out because he hasn't got more. He's got very narrowly less than 50% of the seats in the Scottish Parliament. So he needs a coalition in order for the Scottish Nationals to stay in power. The problem was, the reason for the fallout is a couple of weeks ago, the Scottish government abandoned its 2030 greenhouse gas emissions targets and said, instead of being net zero, it's not net zero, instead of reducing our emissions by 75% by 2030, we're going to say we'll do it by 2045, or 100% by 2045.
Yeah, 100% by 2045.
So they've abandoned the lesser targets for 2030 and set higher targets for 2045. And my understanding, the Greens said, well, we can't support this. We're out of here. They had something called the Butte House Agreement, which is the building where they formed the coalition. Yeah. And they scrapped that. I've actually got a statement from it. The Scottish Greens put out a statement saying, it's an act of political cowardice by the SNP, who are selling out future generations to appease the most reactionary forces in the country. They've broken the bonds of trust, blah, blah, blah.
Well, I thought Youssef had actually pushed them out because he didn't like the response. But, I mean, either way, it hasn't done him any good.
Look, clearly we know our background, but not the detail, which is quite common with us, I think. Woods and trees. But the broad thing is they've fallen out and gone their separate ways, whoever pulled, pushed or pulled away. We don't know between us. But it's all to do with the resetting of the green targets. And it was kind of inevitable. The SNP are blaming the Tories in Westminster.
Of course.
For not giving Scotland enough money. If you'd given us more money, we could have solved all our problems. Kind of missing the point, I think. But they've been missing, what is it? They've failed to meet 8 out of the last 12 of its annual targets. And the Climate Change Committee had said, look, you're not going to meet your 2030 targets. Time for a rethink. And so they've simply followed the advice.
Yeah. But I've always got the feeling that the Scottish Nationalists always wanted to go a little bit further than the British government, you know, in terms of the carbon reduction targets, and would use that as a stick to beat the Tories, because they'd say, you know, we've got far more ambitious net zero targets than the Tories, because the Tories, their heart isn't in it. And of course, they had a field day when Rishi Sunak watered down the UK targets last year. Was it last autumn?
Yeah.
And of course, but now, you know, the Scottish Nationalists realise that they can't hit the target that they had set themselves. It was too ambitious, and they've watered down their own targets, and basically it's come back to bite them. But I think that one of the problems is, of course, that governments have set these targets. British governments, I mean, the national government and the devolved governments have set their own targets, which is all very good. But I think we've said this before. I've certainly said it before. They've done it without really having a proper plan about how to actually achieve these targets. And they're more aspirational than practical, I think. And the thing is that they're learning just how aspirational and unrealistic the targets are. And they're having to basically move the goalposts as they, you know, continue to play. Naturally, the Greens are going to complain if you water down any green targets, because that's what they're ostensibly all about. So it was a problem brewing for a long time.
But I think in many ways, it's better to miss targets than to hit them, because if you miss targets, at least you're always aiming upwards.
Well, yeah.
If you hit targets, you're about to hit the target, and you think, okay, I'm cruising in that direction, you can take your foot off the gas and you can let things slide. So conceptually, and I'm not talking specifically about Scotland or green policy and carbon emissions or whatever, but just conceptually, it's a bit like we learn more from failure than success. That having a target that's perpetually out of reach it keeps you honest, and it keeps you fit, keeps you working.
Yeah. It's quite like one of those platitudes that you see on greetings cards about, yeah, aim for the stars and you'll hit the, I don't know, whatever it is.
The moon,
you
probably.
Know, but yeah, something like that. something like that. And I agree, you know, you've got to be ambitious. And I suppose if it's too easy to hit your targets, then clearly you didn't set your targets high enough. But anyway, there's been a bit of a watering down, and in fact, there's been even more watering down south of the border. I mean, this is obviously related. It's about heat pumps. That heat pumps are basically flavour of the month, and they have been for many months now. That if you want to reduce your carbon footprint, you get rid of your gas boiler and you put in an air source heat pump. Traditionally, traditionally, it's not traditional, but that's basically what it is. You stick an air source heat pump on your outside wall where everybody can see it and say, look how green these people are. And, you save the planet and keep your house warm and all the rest of it. It costs quite a lot of money, but the government are quite happy to sub you up. I think it's about £7,000.
£7,500
to install an air source heat pump. And of course,
that should be about 50%, isn't it? I mean, isn't sort of 12,
something like that? But it's always it's like all these green things. It's wealthy people who can afford to burnish their green credentials because they've got the money to actually do this. They can find the other £7,500 to stick the air source heat pump on their outside wall. But one of the prerequisites of the government's subsidy scheme for this was that if you're going to put a heat pump on your outside wall and, you know, save the planet, first of all, you've got to insulate your house so that you're not wasting all the heat that you're generating from this new heat pump. And the thing is, heat pumps don't generate heat with the same intensity as a fossil fuel boiler, either oil, solid fuel or gas boiler. They just don't do that. They tend to operate at lower temperatures. And you need a far better insulated home to keep that energy in and to make the thing work. It's the sort of, we've heard this phrase many, many times over the years, fabric first. When we're talking about energy efficiency in homes and buildings, basically you've got to make the building capable of retaining the heat. So you've got to have a well-insulated building. It's all part of Part L of the building regulations. And once you've got a well-insulated, warm building, now you can start putting in your clever tech, your heat pumps, in other words, in this case, or your solar panels or whatever it might be. And they will work efficiently within this well-insulated home. Well, now the government's saying, oh, people aren't buying heat pumps quickly enough. You know, we're throwing this money at it, £7,500 towards each heat pump installation. But people aren't taking the bait because they've got to insulate their homes with either, you know, loft insulation or cavity wall insulation before we let them have the money. So we're going to remove that precondition, which is stupid because basically, as I think there's a trade association, the External Cladding Association, the Render and Cladding Association, Insulated Render and Cladding Association, and they represent people who put external cladding on buildings, I think. They're saying this is ridiculous because obviously it's in their interest.
Yeah, they would say that, wouldn't they?
But they're right. I think they're right. You know, I mean, it's no good you or I. I mean, we talked about the leaky, inefficient homes that you and I live in. If I put a heat pump in my house, I wouldn't notice a difference. You know, I'd still be bloody freezing on May the 1st, 2024, even if I had the heat pump, you know, sort of chuntering away at full blast, because basically the house isn't properly insulated. It's got solid walls and it doesn't meet the general requirements. So, you know, a modern house with cavity walls, you can insulate the cavity walls, you can insulate the roof, you can put external insulation. I suppose I could put external insulation on my house. Make the house a warm house, an intrinsically warm house, and then use your heat pumps to basically keep it warm. There's no point removing this precondition for insulating the building. And I think they're absolutely right.
Well, it's whether you should have to do the insulation first. People are still being encouraged to get the insulation done. It's the difference between what we've got now. It used to be the Green Deal, your grants and compost insulation as well. And I think new doors and windows, was that part of the Green Deal? I'm not sure.
Yes, I think so.
But that never worked in two separate incarnations. So they focused the whole grant thing on the heat pumps. And they just want to, we're back on targets. I mean, they set the target of, now then I've got it here somewhere, however many thousands they want to get put in.
600,000 heat pumps a year.
600,000 heat pumps a year by 2028, so in 4 years' time.
Yeah.
In 2022, they did 5,000 heat pumps were sold in the UK, compared to 620,000 in France, which is a similar sort of size to the population.
Hmm.
So yeah. 2 years ago, a trickle of heat pumps. However, I've just looked at the latest stats, came out at the end of March, a month ago. Since the £7,500, since the grant was increased from 5,000 to 7,500, there has been an increase, a 75% increase. In February this year, there were 75% more applications for the grant, which we can, I suppose, take as equivalent to number of heat pumps installed. The 75% increase February 24 against February 2023. So, and applications received between November 23 and February 24 is 45% higher than before the grant uplift. So
So it has helped.
The numbers are going up. Applications soar by 75%. But to be honest, even if we do double this year what we did 2 years ago, well, that's 10,000, which is still a long way off the 600,000 a year that we're supposed to be doing.
Just a bit.
So a 75% upswing is not enough. It needs to be exponential.
Yeah, it must be very frustrating for the policymakers who have these, you know, noble aspirations to decarbonize the economy and all the rest of it, and say to people, look, we're going to give you real money in order to incentivize you to make these green improvements to your home. People just aren't taking the bait. I mean, I've got a friend, actually, who is at this very moment having his house clad with external insulation. It all looks very exciting. I haven't asked him if he's going to put a heat pump in afterwards, but people are doing it. And obviously, it must cost money to have external insulation put on your house. Can't be cheap.
Well, I've just had double glazing fitted, and I'm not feeling the benefit of it yet. But hopefully, hopefully it'll come.
Well, when the government launched its Green Deal, I did think of, because we've got single glazing in most of our windows, and I thought, yeah, I really need to do something about this, because you can almost see the heat disappearing through those windows in the depths of winter. So I looked at the Green Deal, but again, there were conditions. And the first thing, before they would help me, I think they were offering up to £10,000 per household, something like that. It was quite generous. I mean, that would do a couple of windows, basically. But even so, before they would even consider that, no, I had to rip up all my suspended floors and insulate underneath them, which is an even bigger job than replacing windows, because you've got to get all the furniture out. So that was no good. So we still have we now have secondary glazing, which is a bit of a compromise, but it seems to work.
Well, I'll never get the money back for my double glazing. I mean, however efficient it is, that's not going to be a long-term saving in any way, shape or form. I'd have to live for about another 50 years. But
might help you sell the place when you move into a care home, Phil.
I don't have to get the cartridge out every morning and squeegee the windows.
The
rivers on the inside. That stopped, which is a plus.
So green things aren't as popular as they should be, I think, is probably my conclusion from that little conversation.
There's another green story this week. There are always green stories every week at the moment. But this is ostensibly quite a... the Construction Leadership Council would like us to think it's a big thing. But, we'll see. It's a big initiative from their perspective. They've produced this document called 5 Client Carbon Commitments. And with some razzmatazz, they got some major clients: National Highways, Anglian Water, Heathrow Airport, Northumbrian Water, Sellafield, and the Lower Thames Crossing are listed on here. Why they need to be listed when they're part of the Highways Agency, National Highways anyway, I don't know. But they said, yes, we have signed these 5 Client Carbon Commitments. Basically what they're saying is, we're going to use low carbon concrete, low carbon steel, set phase out dates for fossil fuel use. Now that is very, very open to interpretation and very woolly. We're going to set, we will set dates to phase it out. So at some point in the future, we will tell you, we will begin to, at some point in the future, gradually phase it out. We're not saying we'll stop using fossil fuel by any certain end date. Just we will set phase out dates.
They did. I mean, the Lower Thames Crossing did declare they're going to be a net zero project some time ago, didn't they?
We talked about this before. Yeah, they're still going to be buying
billions
of gallons of, millions of gallons of diesel. Going to be using, I think they're not going to be really net zero. They'll be not if they include all the exported, outsourced carbon that's involved in the project, which none of us do. Any thing we have imported from China, any component imported from China, we conveniently exclude the embedded carbon in those products.
Exactly.
It's all smoke and mirrors. However, that's not to detract from it. Targets, make them hard, aim, improve, push, all good. But don't pretend you're clean and green.
There is a hierarchy of sort of greenhouse gas emissions and carbon emissions. And I can't remember, because it's one thing to, I can't remember what the, is it Schedule 1, 2 and 3 or Schedule A, B and C, I can't remember. Basically, to summarise, it's one thing to reduce your own carbon emissions to get your own house in order, but basically you are responsible for a supply chain as a contractor or a major project, and it's quite a different matter to actually reduce the carbon emissions of your supply chain. And I wish I could remember what the system is, how you calculate it, but it's difficult. It isn't easy at all.
But we are, I say we, industry in general, is cranking up and is starting to think about indirect emissions and starting to measure those. And so we're moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
We can always argue about the speed of movement, but whether we'll get there before the planet explodes. you and I will be gone by then, I think, though.
Yeah, I think so. I hope so. All right, what are we going to talk about now?
Well, you mentioned demolition earlier. You got this big demolition feature in the magazine.
Yes,
this is
right.
The May 2024 issue, isn't it?
Yeah, May issue of the magazine is out. Well, I haven't had my copy yet. Went to press a week ago.
Well, you know what's in it. You wrote the damn thing. What's on the front cover?
Well, I can't remember, Phil. It's almost a week ago. On the front cover is a picture of, rather dramatic picture, of some excavators munching a bridge at night on the M25.
Wisley. Wisley Interchange.
The Wisley Interchange. It was
awesome.
It was national news back in, was it March?
It'd be national news again in a month or two's time, I imagine, as well.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, I think later this month they're going to be closing the motorway again. This was it hit the headlines, this job, because it was the first planned closure of the M25 in its entire history, 38 years. I found that quite surprising. I would have thought, I mean, they've been turning into a smart motorway and doing this, that and the other, and there's been constant repairs and stuff like that. But they haven't actually closed the motorway completely, not the entire
circle
length of it around London, but closed a section of it completely so that you couldn't go all the way around. Yes, this was Junction 10, the Wisley Interchange, as you say, which is the busiest. I didn't know this. I've been through it many, many times, but it's the busiest and most dangerous junction on the motorway.
I can believe it's the most dangerous, but I would have thought Heathrow or the M4 would have been the busiest. M1?
Yeah, that's a busy one. But apparently it's Junction 10. Wow. It's quite it is quite busy. It's an interchange with the A3. And
but you can't drive straight on from the A3 to the M25 at the moment. That's why they're having to do this junction. It's you have to you get up the A3 and you have to go to a roundabout and then get onto the
M25. That's right. Yeah, they've got this roundabout in the middle. I mean, they've got to upgrade the capacity of the junction. As you say, you've got this roundabout in the middle of this junction. So it straddles both the motorway and the A3.
It's below the motorway, but you come off the motorway, hit a roundabout, and then turn onto the A3.
Yes. But there are several bridges, both on, obviously at the junction and to the east and the west of the junction on the M25. The bridge which was demolished back in March, it was Balfour Beatty as the main contractor on this job, and they subcontracted the demolition work to True7, East Anglian contractor. True7, actually, that's quite an interesting company itself.
They're quite new to demolition, aren't they?
They are, because True7, which is a business, it started life as Trucks R Us and Trailers R Us or something like that. But anyway, it became abbreviated to True7. It was set up by Guy Nichols, who people might know as a chap who ran a very successful hire company called Fork Rent.
Telehandlers.
Yeah, massive telehandler hire company. He sold Fork Rent to what became Ardent Hire Solutions. When was that? A few years ago now. Basically, he was one of these business.
I reckon. Nine, maybe, something like that.
But Guy Nichols is one of these businessmen who he can't really retire. He can't sit still for too long. Wanted to do something else. So he set up True7. He bought Clark Demolition a couple of years ago, two or three years ago, from a family friend, David Clark. Nearby, another East Anglian firm. David Clark, basically, who inherited the company from his father, now in his 60s, and thought he wanted to take a bit of a back seat. So he was looking for a buyer, not very seriously, I don't think, but, Guy Nichols is an old friend, and he said, well, I'm in the market for a demolition company. So he sold it to him. It was an easy one. In fact, David Clark said to me, he's got two daughters who thankfully aren't interested in demolition. They didn't tell me what they were interested in, but they weren't going to take over the family firm. So he wanted to find a solution. And of course, selling to his one of his best mates was a really attractive solution. Everybody was happy. Anyway, so Clark Demolition is now part of True Seven. And Guy Nichols said to David Clark, well, you're going to stay on because I'm not going to let you retire just yet. So he's not quite out of the woods. But anyway, the company, Clark Demolition, is a bit of a specialist in bridge demolition jobs. And so it landed this job on the M25. In fact, in terms of demolition, it was fairly straightforward because it's not a big bridge. The Clearmount Bridge was a bridle path over the motorway, but it was built in such a way that you couldn't just break it out at the abutments and lift it out. It was steel beams and a concrete deck, and you had to break it out. They broke it out onto a protective layer of bog mats underneath so they didn't ruin the running surface of the motorway. And actually did it, they finished, I think, 6 hours ahead of schedule. And Balfour Beatty were able to, or National Highways were able to open the motorway again 8 hours ahead of the scheduled time. So it was a successful job. It's one of, I think they're...
So do you think if they'd set a higher target, they would have finished it even earlier?
It's interesting. They could have done. David Clark did actually say that he thinks, looking back, there are things they could have done to cut even more time off the schedule. But, you know, he said it was such a high profile job. As you know, virtually everybody knew it was national news. They're closing the M25. And if anything happens on the M25, it's national news. So many people use it. It's so busy. It's got such a checkered history. It's such a poor reputation.
Well, I've said this before, but we talked about this project a couple of months ago when the thing happened. Yes, everyone slags off the M25, but can you imagine living in the South East
without
it? No, of
course not. Not now. No. So anyway, it was a very high profile job. Apparently the Deputy Prime Minister wanted to be kept informed about progress because he knew that, you know, the proverbial would hit the fan if the motorway didn't open again on time. So they built in a really generous margin of error, I think. Yeah, so they took the bridge down. It had to break out the abutments. The reason for this is quite interesting. The improving the junction, they've got to build far more space into the junction. It's too congested, basically. So they're lengthening it, which means that the slip roads start further back. And Clearmount Bridge spanned the motorway, I don't know how many meters, a couple of hundred meters, maybe, from the junction itself. But they had to bring the slip roads back, which meant that they had to widen the road at that point. So the bridge had to go. They're going to replace it. There is going to be another Clearmount Bridge, which will be put 100 yards or so further back. This will be a steel single span bridge. There won't be a central pier supporting it like there was with the one they demolished. And that will be lifted into position by Mammoet, you know, the Dutch. Are they Dutch? Well, they're Belgian. Dutch, aren't they?
Yes, the Sarens are the Belgians. It's always either Mammoet or Sarens.
That'll be another interesting job when they do that. That's not going to happen in a while, though. All the demolition work will be done by the end of the year, apparently, because there are two road bridges still to demolish, because these are the two road bridges over the M25, which form part of the roundabout. So there'll be bigger jobs.
I imagine Mammoet will use these hydraulic platform trailers rather than big cranes.
Yes, that's right.
Job.
Yeah. I don't know exactly what the procedure would be, but yeah, they're going to use one of their big sort of hydraulic multi-axle lifting things. Yeah, so there's another bridge to be demolished, I think, possibly next week. No, week after next, I think. And also what they're doing as well is they're putting these new gantries over the motorway. They've got these new super span gantries, a big, you know, they're just like the overhead gantries, which people are familiar with on motorways, but these are bigger and more, I don't know, maybe more cameras or something like
that. Catchy speeding.
But they're big. And what I hadn't realized was that when they maintain these gantries over the motorway, they usually have to close one of the lanes on the motorway so that people can get up.
Lane or carriageway?
I think it's a lane, not a carriageway, a lane. so that people can get up onto the gantry. It doesn't seem to stop people from just stop oil getting up on the gantry without closing a lane. But no, to do it properly, you've got to close a lane, apparently, which I didn't realise. These new superspan gantries, you don't have to do that. You can get up there and send your maintenance team up while the motorway is just running as normal. So that should help ease congestion as well. It's an interesting, I mean, the location's quite interesting because it's very, Wisley is, of course, where the Royal Horticultural Society's Wisley Gardens are, very famous sort of gardens. Anybody who listens to Radio 4 and Gardeners Question Time will be familiar with Wisley. But it's the whole area. I mean, this junction is right in the middle of this area of Surrey Heathland, which apparently, and I didn't realise this is a site of special scientific interest. It's a sort of unique habitat sort of thing. And so you've got this sort of junction of two roads, more or less 90 degrees to each other, dividing this area of heathland into four quadrants, if you can imagine that, with the two trunk roads going right through the middle of it.
I got you.
The way they're reconfiguring it is they're replacing these bridges. They're going to be better bridges. They're going to be bigger bridges. All four quadrants of this heathland will be connected, including one which is just north of Wisley, I believe. Can't remember what it's called, but it's going. Oh, Cockcrow Bridge is going to be the first sort of heathland garden bridge on the network. It's going to go over the A3, not the M25, but it's going to be several meters wide, about 20 meters wide, and it's going to the heathland is actually going to go across it. So all these animals, deer and badgers and foxes and newts, no doubt, will be able to go backwards and forwards across this bridge. So it's quite a big job. It's got some very, very strict environmental criteria to fulfill, as I'm sure you can imagine. Yeah, so quite interesting. We were focusing on the feature in the magazine focuses on the demolition side of things. That's really just one factor. The whole project as a whole is quite interesting from several different points of view.
The bit that was demolished, that was built in, I'm guessing, in the 80s or 90s?
I don't know when it was built, actually. It's been there for quite a long time. Yeah, probably. When was...
I'm guessing it was something like that. I just wonder whether bridges over motorways nowadays or we talked about this in the context of modern methods of construction and these high-rise buildings that go up in the big tower blocks in the city of London that go up, and 30 years later we decide that they're they're redundant or not good enough or wrong, and we take them down again. And all buildings seem to be temporary. Do you think has the time come? Are we already building bridges with the knowledge that they are temporary, that things we think are permanent, nothing's forever? And I mean, you said that this bridge that 27 demolition knocked out a couple of months ago, they couldn't just lift it out, cut the piers and lift it out. They had to demolish it with teeth. Are we now putting in bridges which can just be lifted out? And is that a threat to the demolition industry?
I don't know if it's a threat to the demolition industry, but I think that small bridge, I mean, if you're talking about something like, the Dartford Bridge, clearly that's going to have to be up there for decades. No, nobody's planning to remove that and replace it anytime soon.
Well, that's like Trigger's Boom. You say that. It's like Trigger's Boom is a suspension bridge or a cable stray bridge, because it'll have new stays, new cables, a new deck at different times. And rather like, Trigger's Boom is had for 100 years, but it's had 18 handles and 25 heads or whatever it is.
But I think with smaller bridges, this one, which was, a bridleway bridge, it's relatively small. And I think... Yeah, the one they will be replacing it with will be a steel structure. There won't be any concrete on it. And it will be single span. There won't be a central pier. This is another thing. There was a pier on top of the central reserve, the barrier between the two carriageways. And so, they had to demolish that as well. The new one won't have that. It'll be single span. So I'm sure that these bridges, modern bridges, are far more easy to install and remove, below a certain size. But coming on to your point about how you know, the short lifespan of structures, you know, how they're demolished so quickly. We've got another feature in the magazine looking at a massive demolition job at the moment near the M4, not the M25, a bit further west.
Oh, let me guess. Swindon,
yes. Anybody who's used the M4 over the past 25, 30 years will be familiar with the Honda factory at Swindon, which is right alongside the motorway there. Well, Honda pulled out of the UK in 2021.
I used to have a Honda, and every time I drove past it, whether it was raining or not, I put the windscreen wipers on so the car could wave at its mummy and daddy.
Well, it was a sad day when they said they were going to be. I mean, a lot of people said it was because of Brexit. It wasn't entirely because of Brexit. It was partly because the EU had relaxed its import restrictions on goods coming from Japan. So now there was no need to build Japanese cars in Europe. So anyway, so Honda decided they're going to pull out. And the site was bought by a massive international real estate developer called Panattoni, who specialise in sheds and stuff like that.
Is that the bread or the meat? I always get the muddled
up. It's the bread, but it's spelled quite differently. Panattoni, very different from that sort of baked goods. So they bought it, and they're building a huge, I can't remember how many billion pounds worth of industrial property there. It's going to be a big industrial park, basically. They're going to be things like, you know, the things which you see going up in the countryside now on brownfield sites or even greenfield sites, data centers, that kind of thing. And so they are redeveloping that. And Winvic, who I think we mentioned many times on the podcast, Winvic, very, very well known for building sheds. That's basically what they do most of. Well, so what they're best known for. They're building, at the moment, they're demolishing the old Honda factory. Now, the Honda factory has been there since, I think, 1985. That's when they started building it. And it's a huge site. It's, I think, about 300 acres, no more than 300 acres. Big site,
A lot of people think 40 years, of course they're knocking it down, but I think you and I think 40 years is nothing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they are being as green as possible about it, because it does seem wasteful when you're talking about a massive car factory and all those buildings and the associated infrastructure. That's all going to be swept away. I mean, I say it's all going to be swept away. They're keeping, a lot of the utilities are there, they'll be kept. The electricity substation is going to be kept. So there are, if you like, services, they can sort of extend them and, you know, into the new buildings, which you're going to put in the place of the old factory. But still, they're knocking down these buildings and hard standing and all the rest of it. They are hoping to, reuse all the steelwork. And we talked about this again, you know, steelwork, of course, in a demolition job, steel is part of the income stream for a demolition company, because they'll sell, you know, scrap has always been something that demolition companies have been involved with, because they, you know, they take out the rebar and the structural steel and they sell it to the the scrap dealers and earn money. This time, they obviously, I think the rebar, some of which is pretty heavy stuff, about 50 millimeters thick, that will obviously have to be scrapped. But the steelwork, the structural steelwork, a lot of it is very heavy, because Honda, being a Japanese company, built all its, you know, its factory specifications were Japanese factory specifications, and and they have earthquakes in Japan, so all
it's cheaper to use their off-the-shelf designs than to have them designed specifically for the UK geology.
Exactly. Mm. So heavy steelwork. And so they're removing the steel beams and columns and trying to keep them intact as much as possible, cutting them to length, trimming them, obviously. And they will be sold to the market for steelwork. They won't be going to scrap. So the same beams and columns, the very self-same beams and columns that came out of the Honda factory, could find themselves being put into a factory or an office building.
Concrete beam with reinforcing steel through it has been cut to length.
No. I think the concrete's all being broken out. They reckon they're going to reuse 100% of the concrete arisings from the demolition on site for fill, aggregate, drainage, that kind of thing. That will all be used, reused on site. The steelwork, none of the steel beams and columns themselves will be reused in the new structures which Windvik will build when all the demolition has finished, which I think will be at the end of this year. But no, they will sell these beams and columns as beams and columns to other projects. So they'll be used for other factories, presumably, maybe office buildings. I don't know.
Funny you should mention that. I ran a piece this morning about a startup company. It's not about, called the Materials Exchange Platform. And I'm amazed it doesn't already exist, actually. And this isn't, they're not talking about concrete and steel. Maybe something exists for concrete and steel. But this startup company, the company's called SoilLink, but it's basically a dating app, you know, an eBay or whatever, called Materials Exchange Platform. Where if you've dug out loads of soil or aggregate from a site and you want to get rid of it, you can put it on this website, this app, and someone else says, "Oh, I need a whole load of aggregate. I can go and get theirs instead of buying virgin stuff or whatever." And it's promoting the recycling of soil and aggregate.
Yeah,
and they've had a first round of seed funding that's been completed. I don't know how much money's gone into it or when it's going to be up and live or whether it'll even work or take off. But it seems such an obvious idea that why are they only doing it for soil and aggregate and not for, as I say, rebar and
other demolition waste? I wonder if people are doing that. It sounds familiar. I mean, does it sound familiar simply because it sounds like a no-brainer, or does it sound familiar because people are already doing it? I don't know. Sounds an interesting one to look into, though.
Yeah. One to watch, yeah.
Yeah, one to watch. So there we are. I mean, so yeah, we've got you've got those two big features in the magazine coming out within the next few days. We're also looking, as I said, at the other side of the demolition sector, why demolition contractors seem to be going out of business at an alarming rate. And, well, that's it on the demolition front for the magazine. We're previewing a big show. There's a big plant show up in Hillhead in Buxton. That's coming up later this month. So I'm sure people will be going up there to have a look at all the yellow equipment trundling around Tarmac's quarry up there, Hillhead Quarry.
Where can people get hold of the magazine?
But via the website. If they don't already subscribe, you can go on the website and order yourself a copy, and it's only cheap. I mean, it's £5 per issue.
Wobble, 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 theconstructionindex.co.uk. You can buy a subscription. And it will in due course be on, you can read it online. But we like to give the paying subscribers first dibs. So,
yeah, absolutely.
You'll have to wait a month or so before you actually see it for free. You're much better off getting your own copy. Put it on expenses and it's free to you as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes, and a bargain. We haven't put our prices up, I think, ever since we launched the magazine. Maybe we should.
Right, any other business?
I think that's about it, actually, Phil.
Yeah. Oh, I did just want to... We talked... some weeks ago about kitchen worktops, engineered stone, quartz, silica quartz. The Australia are introducing a ban. And I don't know if you mentioned this shop in Canterbury, kitchen fitters called Herringbone. And they say, well, we're not going to sell it anymore. They've now set up a petition. They're going further than taking the moral high ground and just not selling the product. But they are now have published a petition or submitted a petition to Parliament to the quote is, the petition is, we want high silica engineered stone worktops banned due to the risk of silicosis resulting from silica dust particles when improperly cut. Mm-hmm. Sign this petition. And if they get 10,000 signatures by 14th of September, Parliament will have to debate it, because that's the way these parliament petitions work.
Yeah.
So they need 10,000 signatures.
How many have they got at the moment?
I've got that wrong. 10,000 signatures, government will respond. 100,000.
Okay.
The petition will be considered for debate. It's not actually definite debate, but considered for debate, 100,000. 2 weeks ago, they put this petition up, and they've got 117. So not a lot of action there. So I'm not sure this is going to go much further, at least for the time being. So
yeah,
if you're in the business of selling silica quartz,
yeah, you're probably safe.
You're probably safe for the time being.
Yeah, your workers might not be unless they're wearing the right respirators.
you're safe as long as you cut it properly.
Yeah, exactly.
The government
has already said. And the government. Was it the HSE?
It was debated, and was the question in the House of Lords again, which we talked about the other week. The government are quite relaxed about it, basically.
Yeah, basically, we've got the protections in place already. If you just follow the rules, you'll be okay.
Yeah, we're good and sensible. We don't need any more laws. Was the thrust of it, just like it was for tobacco, for asbestos, for blah blah blah. So let's see which way the wind blows in 10 years' time, and then our herringbone people.
Just make sure that you're upwind when it does. Okay.
Right. Other than that, bank holiday weekend.
Yes.
My opportunity to, all being well, rain permitting, start digging up some weeds out of my garden.
Good for you.
Enough rewilding. I've had 8 months of rewilding in the garden. Time to re-civilise.
Yes.
Well, thank you everyone for listening. From David and I, for another episode, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.